Also, I gotta correct something. I kind of have this vague memory that I said something wrong the other day, and it was. So you should tell me if I'm remembering this wrong or not. But I'll say it just again, just to be sure that it's right. And then, so there was a question of what the renormalization condition is for pi. So we have pi mu nu. And what I think I remember telling you guys was that pi prime of 0 was 0. Is that what I told you? If so, that's not what I wanted to say. I wanted to say that pi of 0 was 0. Because remember, the criterion was we wanted the residue of the pole of the propagator to be 1. And this was, you know, eta mu nu over p squared 1 minus pi or something like that on p squared. P mu term. I'm just doing that from memory. Let me just check that that's right. Yeah. So you can see that the if you want the residue to be one, then what you're asking is that this is one, and so that's why you want to require that as a criterion. So if I told you that, and I have this vague memory that I did, ignore it. That's what really what we wanted to do. This for the finite piece. Yeah, that's what I wrote. Yeah, so that was when the drugs were kicking in or something. Okay, so what we have is we have a bare charge, which we know is Z1, Z2 inverse, Z3 the minus a half times the real charge. And we know that that was actually equal to 1. So this is really only depends on Z3. And there's another way to think. So that says that the Z3 was a thing that was to do with the wave function normalization of the photon. Remember, A mu was Z3 1/2 A mu. There's another way of arguing why this should have been true. You know, our Lagrangian originally was -1/4 F naught mu nu, naught mu nu. And the way I argued it before was that the relative normalization of these two terms was something which was fixed by gauge invariance. Another way to say the same thing would be that, you know, we could always rescale. We chose to rescale A naught to have this coefficient be 1/4. But what another choice we could have made is we could have rescaled A naught to make this coefficient 1. And so if we take, you know, A naught goes to, 1 over E naught, A naught, then this Lagrangian would have been -1/4 E naught squared. This is actually another commonly used normalization convention. And writing it this way, you can kind of see that it's clear that if you renormalize the gauge field, then you can interpret that as a renormalization of the gauge coupling. And this way of writing the gauge coupling is instructive because it shows you that if you had a whole bunch of different kinds of matter fields, you've put all of the gauge coupling in the kinetic term of the photon. And so it shows you that you get to argue about the numerical charge of the various things, but the coupling constant is something which is universal to everybody for a gauge field. So this is another rationalization why gauge invariance is telling us that only the wave function normalization of the photon is relevant for the size of the charge. So we calculated what z was. So if we had pi of q squared with some divergent piece plus the finite part, and then this criterion up there said that we wanted to choose Z3 to be 1 plus C. That was the thing that ensured that. So this pi f of 0 was going to be required to satisfy this this renormalization condition. And but we know what C and pi are because we worked them out. So C was, when we calculated it before, it was minus e squared over 12 pi squared, 1 over 2 minus d over 2, minus the Euler Mascherelli constant, and then we had pi f of q squared was 2e squared over 2 pi squared. Which has the property that if q were 0, then the log would be 0. And so it vanishes at q squared equals 0. So if we take this for c, we know what z3 is. So z3 is be 1 plus c, it'll be 1 minus squared over 2 pi, 12 pi squared. So, there's just kind of one thing I want to say before switching to a different way of thinking about this. But one thing you can see that is appearing here is this scale mu, which was this dimensional regularization scale, which we put in to make the coupling constant be dimensionless in arbitrary dimensions. Because the electromagnetic coupling actually would have had dimensions if we were not in four dimensions. So mu was carrying the burden of that. And it kind of comes along for the ride at the end of the day. As we take mu to the d to 4, it survives because it would have only appeared proportional to d minus 4, but then this divergence multiplies that and leaves us a finite part that depends on mu. So that means that bottom line is that z3 depends on mu. And so that means that the original variables didn't depend on mu. So that means that if this depends on mu, then e is actually also depending on mu. So Z3 depending on mu is also a function of mu. And you might say, well, so what value of mu am I supposed to use when I calculate things? And the important thing is that it doesn't matter. And it doesn't matter because if you calculate something else, like the energy levels of the hydrogen atom or something, what will happen is it'll depend on E, your correction, once you do include radiative corrections. But typically, it'll also explicitly depend on mu, because whatever the calculation that you do for your observable, it will also diverge. It'll have ultraviolet divergences. And so those things, once you regulate them dimensionally, will have factors like this log of mu. And so if you calculate, an observable, so something like a cross section or something which is physical that you could measure, it'll be a function of things like the energies at which you're measuring the process. It'll depend on the electron mass. It'll depend on E, but it also will typically depend explicitly on mu, because this will enter the same way it did here. Enters through regularization of divergences. And the point is that physical things don't depend on mu, and that what that means is that the explicit mu dependence that you get in these calculations is going to be canceled by the implicit mu dependence that you have in these renormalized parameters in your problem. So there's a explicit mu dependence you'll have, but we've also just seen that there's an implicit mu dependence in the renormalized parameters. And these two mu dependencies cancel. And they cancel for the same reason. That's another way of saying that the divergence is canceled. So I claim that you could absorb the divergences into these renormalized quantities. And you're getting these mu's as finite parts when you're separating the divergent part and the finite part, there's an ambiguity as to what the finite part is, because you can always add a finite part to the divergent part and it still diverges. And so this mu dependence is kind of a residual leftover from the regularization dependence you had. And the fact that these mu's cancel is the same statement as the statement that the ultraviolet divergences cancel. But it's useful to make this observation explicit, because on dimensional grounds, often you're interested in limits where, say, the energy is large compared to the mass, let's say. And on dimensional grounds, if this had been a cross-section, say, then you could factor out a factor of 1 over e squared on dimensional grounds, because cross-sections go like 1 over energy squared. And there'd be some dimensionless function of what's left. And so it could have been a function of e over m, e, and, say, mu over m. But the fact that the mu dependence is actually fictitious at some level, because it's canceling between the mu dependence here and here, shows you that if you're interested in, say, you're often interested in the limit where the energies are large or small compared to m. And as we'll see later on, these functions tend to have large logarithms of that ratio, e over m, when the ratio is large. And there's a very simple way to identify how things depend on that ratio, because what you do is, I think what I wanted to do was to what I'm saying now won't be clear until I actually do the example, but the statement is that let me choose to scale out mu everywhere. Since mu is arbitrary, I can choose it to be whatever I like. And so it's convenient to choose it to be the biggest scale in the problem. So I could choose mu to be e, let's say, in which case this ratio is order 1. Then the large logarithms then are all in the ratios of mu over m. But because the mu dependence of this formula is the explicit mu dependence is canceling the implicit mu dependence, I can infer what the dependencies on large logarithms of mu over m once and for all by figuring out how e depends on mu, because any large logarithm here is going to have to systematically cancel any large logarithm in e. And so it's worth once and for all identifying how e depends on mu, because in the end of the day, when I actually look at observables, that mu dependence of e is going to be encoding important information about the answer. In particular, it'll be encoding how it depends on ratios of energies when those ratios are large, and how to track large logarithms. So I want to take a little detour to identify how E depends on mu. And at some level, it's a stupid question to ask, because we know how E depends on mu. It's given by this, so E naught is equal to this times this. If E naught doesn't depend on mu, and we know explicitly what Z is, then we know what E is, right? Then we know the mu dependence of E. And that's true. So one way to think about this mu dependence is that E of mu It's just E naught times Z3 to the minus a half, I guess, or plus a half of mu. So if that's mu independent, then that means that the mu dependence is explicit now. I can write this as being E naught times, so Z3 to the 1/2 will be, given that this is, you know, this is small, I can take Z3 to the 1/2 as being approximately 1 minus E squared over 24 pi squared times 1 over. So here's the mu dependence explicitly. And so now we know what it is. But there's a what looks like a really naive move that you can make, which is actually not such a naive move in the end of the day. So another way of saying this, encoding the mu dependence here, is I could take mu dd mu of E. And that has the advantage that a lot of the stuff drops out. All I'm going to really see is if I take mu dd mu, the logarithm is if I take dd mu, I'm going to get log mu is going to give me 1 over mu, and then mu dd mu will just cancel the 1 over mu. So if I think of this as being, I pull out the factors of, there's a mu squared here, so there's a factor of 2 here that I should think of in terms of when I think of log mu. And this is in the denominator, so it's really a minus log mu that I've got here. So I've got a plus 2 log mu in this factor here. So if I take mu dd mu of this thing, I'm going to get, if I combine these e's, I'm going to get e. And the difference between E naught and E is something which is, again, higher order in E. So if I'm going to look at this first term, I can think of just that as being E cubed. There's a sign, there's a minus. This was a minus times a minus. There's a plus 2. So there's a total of minus 12 pi squared. I've done that right. Plus 2 log mu. So the 2 makes it a 12, and then that minus sign goes out to the line. I don't need.
Just to make sure. So Z3 is an infinite parameter you're multiplying if you're vector.
It's only infinite if D equals to 4. But we've regulated by having D very close to 4, but not exactly at 4.
Okay.
So it's large but finite.
But in real physical examples, it's going to be infinite?
No, it's never infinite. That's actually the fallacy that people had in the old days. So I'm gonna actually look at this again, where we had put a cutoff, and this is gonna become something like log of a cutoff divided by m squared. And so, for any cutoff, that has to be large. This cutoff has to be large compared to your application of interest. So much bigger than the m, say. So let's say it's 10 to the 6 GeV. So we have nothing of what that physics is. Then this logarithm is 10 or something like that. So it's finite but large, but not enormous. If this is the Planck scale, this is still not enormous. This is Planck scale divided by the electron mass. But once you take the log, you get something of order, 50 or something like that. So you should really think of this as being something which is large, but not infinitely large. And a lot of the things that people did in the 50s that got them into trouble was that they were thinking of taking lambda to infinity, and you shouldn't think of that. It's really lambda is some large scale about which you do not know the physics, but it's large, but not infinitely large. And then once you say that, then you can kind of see that these are, you're never actually taking the hard limit that lambda is infinite. And that makes, if you did take that limit, it would be hard to think about these things. But okay. I'll come back to that in a second. So the same thing for D. D is 4 minus a very small bit. Now this encodes the same information as this, you might have said. So I could integrate it and get the same thing back, right? I could, if I integrate this, I think of that as being, dE, d log of mu is equal to minus e cubed over 12 pi squared. Then that would say that, dE over e cubed is minus d log mu over 12 pi squared. So if we integrate that, that says that, integrate that from, say E1 to E2, I'll integrate from U1 to mu2. That would say that if I integrate this, I'm going to get e to the minus 2 was minus 2, right? I'll get 1/2 1 over e squared 1 minus 1 over e squared 2. I've done this right. This should be positive. I think that's right. We'll check it all in the end. It's equal to minus 1 over 12 pi squared logarithm of mu 2 over mu 1. So if I differentiate this, I get e to the minus 2. Minus 2 comes down. Let me think of E2 as being the variable I'm differentiating. So I get e to the minus 2. The minus 2 comes down. Cancel that. That gives me, I think that's right. So this shows you that you know how E depends on mu more explicitly. It says that 1 over E squared, you know, mu 2, that one, is equal to 1 over E squared of mu 1. If I put that on that side, I have to put this on the other side. 1 over 12 pi squared. I guess 1 over 6 pi squared. Log 2 over mu 1. And so if I solve for E, you know, if I use the fact that E is actually perturbatively small, this would reproduce this expression that we have already here, this mu dependence. But there's actually more content to this than there is to this original expression. And that's because in this expression, to get you know the difference between this expression and this expression, or I could derive this expression from this expression if I'm expanding in powers of the small thing, and I'm assuming in particular that e squared times the logarithm is small. So this expression requires that e cubed log of m squared over 2 pi mu squared is much less than 1. But this expression didn't rely on that. This expression really only relies on e squared is much less than 1. So the domain of validity of this formula is actually larger than the domain of validity of this formula, because there will be regions where you can imagine the logarithm being large. And so this could be order 1, even though e is small. Yeah.
What did you get that beta function?
This here? I just differentiated this thing. I took mu d to mu of this expression.
How do you get eq differentiated?
Because there were two here, and there's that one. And e naught differs from e by something order e squared, so I just said that in here they're the same. So at first face value, it looks stupid, right? I took an equation, I differentiated it, and I integrated it again. How could I learn anything from that? And the reason that that's a useful step to do is that this equation relies on this being true. But this equation actually has a larger domain of validity because it only relies on this being true. So if I integrate it, this equation has a broader domain of validity than this one does, because this one only really relies on e squared being small. And it still applies if e squared log of mu 2 over mu 1 is order 1. So this equation is actually more accurate than this one is. But if I did assume that this was very, very small, and I Taylor expanded this equation, then I would just get this one back, and then that's gotten that. So in the limit that this is small, these expressions agree. But this expression has actually got a broader domain of validity as the main point. And so this is something I'm going to come back to later on, that the fact that you can identify the mu dependence of E in this regime where E is small, so you're doing perturbation theory, but you're not assuming that E squared times the logarithm is small, is actually very useful, because when we come back to looking at physical observables, the dependence on ratios of scale, you know, we're really interested in following is E over M. But we can follow that by choosing mu equals E, say, and then we're following the ratios of mu divided by other scales in physical observables is something which is an interesting thing to follow, because that's actually a big logarithm in the answer. But the fact that mu drops out of this answer means that we can trade the explicit mu dependence for the implicit mu dependence of E. And we know the implicit mu dependence of E actually very generally, if E is small. And so What this is going to allow us to do is it's going to allow us to calculate examples of things where we do calculate them in the approximation that e squared times a logarithm is small. And what we'll do is we'll find that we can, for free, using the fact that mu doesn't depend on the answer, infer what the answer would have been if we'd actually summed all the contributions that were all the contributions for which e squared is small, but where e squared times the logarithm was not small. And this, and it's called renormalization group improvement. But it's basically the logic of the argument will be that if you know the mu dependence of e, you can infer what the mu dependence that was not in e in any observable was, because you know that nothing depends on mu. And the mu dependence of e, you have a very broad statement of what it is from this argument that thinks of this as being the primary equation rather than this one, because it has a broader domain of validity. And so this is called the renormalization group equation. So it tells you how things change as you change mu in this particular case. And the right-hand side is what you would call the beta function. It's often called beta of e. And then solutions of that, like this one, when you use them and you actually apply them to a region like this where this e squared times the logarithm is order one, are renormalization group improved expression in the sense that you're inferring the dependence on mu in a regime that you didn't really have in your original calculation, but you can get to through the artifice of recognizing this derivative equation has a broader domain of validity than this original one did. This is the normalization group improved. Improved in the sense that it's got a broader domain of validity.
What guarantees you that this derivative equation has a large domain of validity? I mean, the equation itself doesn't break down. You derive it from an expression that breaks down as those skills by the logarithms are large. So how do you know that there's not other contributions to this derivative equation that are equally large, that is?
It's because
e squared log squared or something, or e to the fourth log squared, whatever.
It's because we know that another way of saying it is that if we took ddm squared of this, we knew that in the end of the day that's a finite answer, right? Because we know that the thing that we're calculating was just barely diverging, it was logarithmically diverging. So you take ddm squared, ddm squared of that, and you get something which is finite. And so it can't, m squared, ddm squared of this quantity can't depend on any regularization issues like mu in particular. And so that's essentially what's underlying this argument, that that you know that the thing that you're trying to follow is to do with the regularization of the divergence, and the divergence was just barely there. So once you take a derivative, it's gone. And since it's gone, then you know that there is no dependence on mu. The thing that you'd be worried about would be that somehow there's some dependence on mu that could show up here. But for that to happen, there would have had to have been a divergence in the derivative of that integral that we'd done. But since the original thing was only logarithmically divergent, once we differentiated it, we had a finite answer. So nothing depends on it. Then you don't have to regulate it.
It's so this is also true if you don't regularization theory in e squared the same.
It is true, although it's more subtle, because once you go past the first loop, then there's issues as to exactly, it starts to depend on exactly how you define e. And so then you can define e in a way which could depend more complicated on more combinations of variables, in particular on masses. Or you could also just define your coupling constant in such a way that it doesn't depend on masses, and that's a choice that you get to make. But the things start to depend on how you make your choices as you go further down the loop expansion. And so I haven't made that argument yet, but I will, that this first one loop contribution doesn't depend. If you define any renormalized definitions of E that differ from one another by higher orders of E will all share this first term in the beta function, so you don't have to care. But if you do go past the first term, then you have to start thinking more carefully about exactly how you define E. Yeah?
Why does the first equation have that domain of validity?
Sorry?
Why What is the first equation of that domain of validity?
This one here?
Yeah. That e cubed the log.
Well, what happens if this is something which I didn't show it, but if you look at graphs, if you kind of take higher order graphs and you start inserting more and more loops, then you know, what makes this argument ultimately useful is that if you just calculate processes and you ask how they depend on large ratios like E over M, what happens is that every additional loop gives you an additional power of logarithm of E over M. So it turns out that the function you're looking at is a function, it's not just a function which is, say, growing like logarithm of E over M with a coefficient that's a series in alpha, or E. It's really something where every order in E is more sensitive to, involves a higher power of logarithm of E over M. So what you're really looking at here is a series in E squared times the logarithm. And so since that's something which won't be clear until you actually look at two loops. But so I'm just telling you what happens at two loops. If you did at two loops, if you'd done the calculation, you would have found that you wouldn't have just found E squared times the logarithm, you would have found E to the fourth times logarithm squared. Right? And so given that each loop order is giving you an additional log for every E, that shows you that if you stop at any loop order, you really were making this assumption. But from what I've calculated so far, you wouldn't know because I haven't shown you that you actually get something worse at higher orders. But I'm just telling you that that's what happens.
So you said E to the fourth log squared.
Yeah.
But here you have E cubed, just log.
Well, the relative order of everything is always E squared times the logarithm. And so if you went to the E to the fourth, if it was the 1 plus E to the fourth term, you would have E to the fourth log squared, E to the sixth log cubed, and so on.
So what I mean is maybe there you mean E squared instead of E cubed?
Yeah, I should have said E squared. Should have also put 8 pi squared.
Quick question with the beta function. If we were being picky and we weren't going to let ourselves trade the E zero for an E, right, then that that beta function would essentially have an E squared dependence, not an E cubed dependence on the right hand side, right? That would change the whole story about what your RG improvement would be, right?
But you can't do that, right? Because the statement you're making here is that E and E naught differ by E squared, right? So the thing is, you're assuming that you're doing a Taylor series in E, you said that these things are equal to first order, and they're just differing by the next order. Mm-hmm. So then if they're differing by next order, in this term, the difference between E naught, E squared, and E cubed is something which is even higher order, which I didn't calculate. But I would be wrong to say there was a difference between E naught, E squared, and E cubed in this term, because the difference is something which is something I haven't calculated yet. It's something which I've neglected. That only becomes a problem if you start thinking of these things being infinite. You know, the D was really equal to 4. Because then it looks like there's non-commuting limits, but never actually take your regulator to be infinite. And if for any finite value, even if it's large, then it's true that this really is a series. It's like there's no big deal here. And if this quantity is small, then you're doing a series in E, and the difference between E naught and E is some finite thing, but it's order E squared.
It just seems odd that you'd be wrong to confuse them in the first equation, and then you differentiate, and then you'd be wrong not to confuse them in the beta function.
If you keep them in the second equation, the derivative equation, if you want to integrate it, and there's an E naught still there, then that's E naught of E squared, right? So you cannot take that as a constant in your beta function equation. So if it says E naught E squared, and you want to integrate it, then you have to take the dependence of E naught on E into account. And that's actually what it's doing to first order. So you get extra contributions that are E to the fourth or fifth or something like that. But they don't matter.
You're worried that somehow this is me dependent and this is not. And so in deriving this, I've used that fact. And so that they should be treated differently. Because I did do that, right? All the mu dependence was here. The only thing I actually differentiated was this. And I did that because, you know, at some level, the leading order thing was E naught, which didn't depend on mu. And so So to the accuracy I'm working, it was explicit mean dependence was what I had to follow. So I could have written this as E naught squared, right? Because they're all the same at this order. And that might have been a more honest way to do it, because then that makes it clear that the only mu's are this is the only mu in the problem. This one here. Yeah, this one, because here what I'm doing is, and this is what Matt's objecting to, is that the left-hand side, this was really E of mu. And then on the right-hand side, we've got E naught cubed, but then E naught minus E of mu is something which is order E squared. So to order E cubed, E naught and E are the same here. So I've used it, I'm using E here, not E naught, because I can do that. To the arc at which I'm working. And when I do that, you know, I derive something which I can then compare to this answer, and I can, by expanding this out, I reproduce what I knew to be true. Looks like magic when you do it. I'll come back to the, I'm kind of just saying that in passing because we're going to talk about it more later on, but I wanted to just... as we go by it, mention that we have some expression here. And in particular, you can kind of see that as if mu 2 is bigger than mu 1, so this logarithm is positive, that would mean that this is bigger than this. So e squared of mu 2 would have to be smaller than e squared of mu 1. I said that right. So I must have a sign wrong there. So if I plot how e varies with mu, this would be saying that 1 over e squared grows with mu. So that means that e must be falling with mu. So something like that. And that's exactly wrong. So I must have made a sign mistake somewhere. Here you mean? But this is the integral of that, right?
But E2 has to come first.
No, there's a minus sign when I do the integral, right? That's a,
your objection is that it falls when you increase mu, because...
Yeah, E should be growing as I increase mu.
But if you just look at the differential equation, its rate of change with mu is negative, right? Because everything on the right hand side.
Yeah, I suspect this is already wrong here.
Yeah.
Because a negative beta function is something which is something which you don't normally get. That means I've probably got something wrong here.
Define beta function, you usually take the derivative with respect to the log of cutoff, right?
Well, there's various ways to define beta function, and that's one way you could have done it, but I did it by varying the renormalization point.
Right. I suspect there will be a minus sign when you rewrite the log of x, right? Take the derivative with respect to the parameter instead of the log of it.
Well, this, but the way I'm defining it, I think it should have been true that I got. Let's go back to here. So we had this C had the overall minus sign. So C here would have been a plus E squared log M. That's what we have here. Plus E squared log M. And the power here is right.
I
Yeah, so let me check. I should just not try and track that down in real time. There's something I've done wrong here in the signs, and it's already wrong here, I think, which means that there's a sign askew here.
I found it.
Oh, what do you think?
There's that equation between the renormalization group and the integral. There's two negative signs, and then in the next equation, there's only one.
Here to here, you mean?
No, back a step.
Here?
What? It's in the middle of the board.
Here.
Yeah. Or is that just the height?
Just
this is just an arrow, yeah. There's something here which it's going to probably be. I did this in my head, and this is where I would mostly be worried about it. So we have minus times minus should be plus. Then I got myself a minus again because of the mu. Let me come back to this thing, because this is something which... My worry is that I've set up the whole argument backwards, that I might have wanted to say that the mu dependence was an E naught. We're going to arrange for E to be. So let me get that right before I try and do that in real time. But there's a sign that I've done wrong here, which I'll have to fix for you. Yeah.
Would it have been equivalent if you just took the derivative of the equation over there and set it to zero, the derivative of E naught with respect to mu, and set it equal to zero?
Well, that should be the same thing, yeah. Because what I did was I put the Z3 on the other side.
But then when you put it on the other side, you didn't... Well, oh.
Yeah, let me come back to that, because it's something which I think that there's a... We're going to kind of approach this from another direction anyway, so... It might be true that it'll come out better. You'll see what's going on better that way. Again, it's going to be more what you said. I'm going to think of this now in terms of the cutoff. Because what I like to do is argue that this expression, you know, there's the words that people always say. You can say, why is this charge changing? So what's it mean for the charge to change with different scales? And the words that people always say are that if you took a charge. And what's happening is that it's like there's little virtual electron-positron pairs that are always in the vacuum. But once you put a charge there, then you know if this is a positive charge and it likes to track the electron in, then it likes to repel the positron in. So the vacuum is behaving like a polarizable medium. It's like there's a whole bunch of charges in the medium that it's like water. If you stick something in, then all the polarized charges like to align themselves in such a way that they partially screen a charge you stuck in. And the vacuum is acting that way if you think of as containing these electron positron fluctuations. And so those are the words that people say, and I want to actually fill them in to show you that really that this expression, this finite part, is telling you essentially what the charge, there's essentially an induced charge profile, rho of r, that's produced by any given charge q, q naught if you like. And when you other charges interact with this charge, they're interacting with this whole charge distribution, not just the bare charge you stuck in there. And this pi captures that. So if you look at scattering, if you have something like scattering, electromagnetic scattering from two very big heavy charges. So think these are muons or something bigger than that are much more massive than the electron. So I should maybe draw them with two lines to emphasize that they're heavy compared to electron. So then the electron, you know, what we've kind of looked at is the electron vacuum polarization. And you could also imagine that there would be things like whatever this new particle is, it could also have a vacuum polarization. And there'd be, you know, vertex corrections and all kinds of things that would be correcting things. But in the limit that the electron is much lighter than everybody else, then this is actually the thing that dominates all these other things, because these are all suppressed by the mass of the particle whose charge you're following. So if this electron is much lighter than everybody else, then the first approximation is just really only these two things. This is the leading correction to the direct scattering from photon exchange. And I want to show you that for non-relativistic things, if these are very heavy, the physics you get from this is exactly the physics you would have gotten from scattering from a charge distribution that's around the given charge. And the profile is calculable in terms of the pi of q squared. So this pi of q squared is telling you explicitly what the charge distribution is that's set up around a given air charge. And if you kind of follow, your charge is conserved at some level. And if you're just polarizing the vacuum, you're not going to get any charge. But as soon as you think that there's a scale beyond which you don't know what's going on, so there's some sort of a little region inside of which you don't really know what's going on, and that this charge that you've inserted is inside that, when you polarize things, this charge distribution will extend into that region that you thought you don't understand. And if you start cutting things off here, which is what we're going to do if I start thinking in terms of a cutoff, then you can actually accumulate a surface charge here. And that accumulated surface charge will be, if you didn't have that surface charge, polarization can't change the net charge, because all you're doing is you're moving charges around. And if your medium is electrically neutral, you can redistribute where the charges are, but you can't change the total number there is. And so if you stick in a net charge, the total value of the net charge you've added will not be changed by the polarization. But if there's a small region around the charge that you don't understand, that you think that the physics could be different, then this polarization in principle is going to would extend into that region. If you stop it from extending in that region, then what you're going to effectively do is you're going to accumulate a charge on this boundary. And that accumulated charge is going to screen the charge you stuck in, and it's going to make it look like if you measured the Gaussian, you know, the Gaussian electric field here and you measured it out here, now you're going to get different answers, because the polarization that was totally electrically neutral partly extends inside this region, and now you've the charges that went inside now make a difference, because they're contributing to your Gaussian field. And so the field that you'd see here and the field that you'd see here are going to be different. And so the charge effectively that you'd measure out at larger distances, this distance is going to be set by something like the inverse electron, the electron Compton radius, because that's kind of how big in position space. If you ask kind of how big is this contribution, the only scale in this problem is basically set by Q over M. And so the typical scale distance over which these effects will be appreciable will be set by the Compton wave of the electron. So that's the physics of why the charge is changing is really set by the screening of the vacuum. And so this story that I was telling you over here in a garbled way, I'm going to retell you in terms of a cutoff, in which you can think of the infinite part telling you directly how the charge here is related to the charge out here. But then you can kind of see that the explicit charge profile that describes this distribution here coming from the finite part also dictates in particular what the radius dependence is. And I'm going to argue that the radius dependence of the charge profile goes like 1 over r cubed as you approach if this q squared dependence tells you that this for small r goes like 1 over r cubed, and that tells you how the charges would build up here. And you'll see it's exactly the same answer that you get here for the cutoff dependence. And so the renormalization of the charge that you're capturing here is really capturing the physical screening of these electron-positron pairs and how they respond to a charge you stick in. So I want to kind of flesh out the math that's behind those words that everybody always says. And so what we'll do is we'll first look at the, I'll just essentially do what I just did, but I'll express it in terms of a cutoff rather than, you know, a distance cutoff or a momentum cutoff. And then the expression here for Z, instead of being a function of dimension, will be in four dimensions, but it'll depend on that cutoff. And then we can compare the answer we would get for the charge as to how it depends on the cutoff coming from this term and the fact that Z is related to that to the charge distribution that we can get from the finite piece. And you'll see that they're telling you the same thing. Okay, so let's start that. So you know that if we had been, you know, we were calculating originally this, that's how we got, this is the list of something like integral d4 some loop momentum p. We had two factors of, we had p squared a to mu nu minus p mu p nu that came out front. So we had two external momenta. And altogether, we expected to have one over, because these are Fermion propagators, we expect to have one over momentum twice, one for each propagator. So we expected to get one over p squared. But once we've extracted two powers of, let me call this q for the external momentum. Once we extracted two powers of external momentum for gauge invariance, then we had to have, you know, two more powers in the integrand. And so we were getting something which was logarithmically divergent. And so we regulated this in d dimensions before. What I want to do now is instead of that, is regulate it with an ultraviolet cutoff in four dimensions. And this kind of power counting shows you that what we were expecting was that pi of q squared was going to go like, again, a constant plus the finite part. And the constant we're expecting is going to be, it'll be e squared over, it'll be some number, let's just call it, say k, times the logarithm of lambda divided by some scale. What's the scale? The only other scale in the problem is the mass of the electron. So there had to be something like this. If we had done this with a cutoff, we would have found that we had some pure number in front times a logarithm of the cutoff. So what's that number? We could calculate it, but we don't have to recalculate it again because we've done the calculation. So the thing to do is to notice that m squared dk dc, I guess, dm squared. That's something which we can just evaluate here, right? It's just minus k. And that's something which is finite. Because if we take ddm squared of this, you know, we pull down another propagator, and then that takes a logarithmically divergent answer and makes it into a finite answer. That was kind of the argument that we knew that this thing didn't depend on momenta. But now I'm doing it for mass. So this is something which is lambda independent when lambda is large. So it's independent of the regularization scheme. And so what I could do is I can compare it. We know what the answer is in dimensional regularization. So if I go back to here and I calculate, here. C was, this is basically C, right? This is, so if I want to know what the m squared dependence of C is, I can calculate it from that, and it has to be regularization independent, and it will be, because if I differentiate with respect to m, I'm going to pick up this term, I'm going to lose the pole completely, I'm going to lose the d minus 4 stuff. If I take d to 4, I'm just going to get some number. And so that allows to figure out what k is without doing any work, because we know that this thing is regularization independent. So in particular, lambda independent, or d independent, if we had done the dimensional regularization. So if we take the dimensional regularization result, that's going to be, so here again, we have the minus times the minus is a plus, and the m squared is in the numerator. So we're going to get the e squared over 12 pi squared. So it has to be the answer that we would have gotten here. So that means that these have to be equal. So k has to be minus e squared over 12 pi squared. So that means that we know that if we'd done a cutoff, we would have found minus e squared over 12 pi squared log of lambda squared over m squared plus order 1 pieces that are not enhanced by lambda. And since I'm now suspicious of all my signs, let me just check the sign. That seems like that's okay. Okay. So if I've, that's right. You can kind of see that, so now Z3 is 1 plus C. So that'll be 1 minus E squared over 12 pi squared. 1 lambda squared over M squared. Order. And I should put the order 1 inside the order 1 doesn't mean it's competing with the 1 here. It means that it's multiplied by the square root of 12 pi squared. So there'd be so this is all small compared to this. So again, if lambda, so we imagine that lambda is much bigger than m, and but you know, say not the Planck scale, but some big scale. So the logarithm will be 50 or some big number, but finite. And as long as this thing, you know, we're thinking e is 0.2, so this thing is 10 to the minus 2 or 3 or something like that, you can see that this is small, and z is less than 1. So if finite, so that this perturbative thing is small, so then z3 is less than 1. And that means that if we calculated you know, so E naught was Z3 to the minus 1/2 times E. That means that if Z3 is less than 1, we're saying that E naught is bigger than E. So in this picture that we're going to come to, if you stick in a charge in here, the charge that you stick in, and if you measure the charge at small distances, which is going to be, you know, what we're going to call the bare charge, it's going to be bigger than the charge you would have measured at larger distances, which is to say that the charge got screened, that you put a big charge in here, but then it got partially screened by the electron positive front pairs, and you ended up seeing a smaller charge than the one you started off with. Why?
Lambda over m.
You want lambda to go to infinity.
No, but it's lambda over m, so it's much larger than 1.
Let's take lambda to be 10 to the 10 GeV, which is way beyond anything we can ever measure. It only becomes, so the point I'm trying to make is that, you know, this is way bigger than any lambda you could ever possibly physically think is being reasonable. So if I take that and I put in the numbers, right, so then lambda over m, so m is 10 to the minus 3 GeV, so this is like 10 to the 13. Now the logarithm of that is, you know, 40. So now we've got 40 times 10 to the minus 3. This really is small, right? And you only have trouble if you really think lambda is exponentially large compared to Planck scale, which is just, so don't do that. It does show you that, you know, if you did try to get exponentially large compared to Planck scale, something is going to go funny. And there is something that was funny, which is to do with the sign that I was getting wrong there. The charge should have been getting stronger as you got to higher energies, and so there should be a sickness that you hit eventually. But it's at very high energies that you hit it. Okay, so that's the picture we're thinking, is that the bare charge will be bigger than the renormalized charge. And I want to tell you a story, which is going to be that this finite, so that was so far what I told you was to do with this, but now we want to tell the same story coming from this. And so what I want to do is build up the expression for what this charge distribution would be given this. And the way we'll do that is we'll imagine looking at the non-relativistic scattering and looking at only these terms. And the justification for not looking at other corrections would be that these things whose charges we're looking at are very heavy compared to the electron. And then what we'll do is we'll compare the scattering that we get in that limit to what you would have gotten from a potential. And so we can read off what the potential would have been in terms of what pi is, because this is essentially the thing that's telling you that it's not just the Coulomb potential. If we started with, if we just had this thing, and we looked and we compared the result we get in the non-relativistic limit to a potential scattering, then you're not going to be surprised to find that we're going to find that the potential that we would have been led to is the Coulomb potential. And so this will correct it. And the interesting thing will be how does it correct it? So we'll read off a formula for the correction to the potential as a function of pi. And then I want to show you that if you're thinking in terms of the potential being changed because there was a charge distribution, then you can relate the potential change to the charge distribution. And so you can ask what charge distribution would correspond to the pi that we had. And so there will be a charge distribution that captures the potential scattering that we're going to get. And ultimately, I'll be able to derive for you a formula for this charge distribution as a function of pi. And in particular, we can then ask, how does it depend for small r as we get near to this cutoff? And then you'll see that the cutoff dependence will be exactly what we just wrote down here. That this expression that we've been writing down here is capturing this charge dependence and how it depends on this physical cutoff here. OK, so let's do the scattering story. So if we actually, before we do the scattering story, I guess I can. So what? Given that I'm going to be able to give you a charge distribution here, what you can do is right away you can ask how does the small r limit of the charge distribution compare to what you think the cutoff dependence should be of the charge? So let me make that argument first. So let's suppose that we know that that these two charges. So suppose, I'll come back to why this is true, that Q is equal to Q naught plus the integral from small distances, so let's call this small distance lambda inverse, to large distances, so since this is some scale which is bigger, I'll take the Compton wavelength of the electron, but it's any scale which is large, because we're interested in the stuff that's singular as lambda gets small, or lambda gets large, so lambda inverse gets small. Times 4 pi r squared rho of r dr. So we imagine we have some charge distribution here. So if we had a charge distribution, then and this charge is supposed to be the bare charge, and this is the not bare charge, then this says that q minus q naught is this integral. But q minus q naught, according to this, would have been Z3 to the 1 half minus 1 times Q naught. Have I done that right? Okay, so that would be the integral lambda inverse. So that says that Z3 minus 1 is going to be 1 over Q naught integral lambda inverse to lambda inverse. And this is the left-hand side is the thing we know is equal to what we just calculated here, right? So where's Z3 is this. So Z3 to the 1 half is just going to, Z3 to the 1 half is just going to, I have to divide this by half, and then I subtract 1. This side is going to be minus e squared over 24 pi squared log of lambda squared over m squared. So what I should be expecting here, what I'm trying to do here is figure out what would be the rho dependence, the r dependence of rho that I would need to capture this so that when I get it, you'll recognize it. So to get something which is logarithmically dependent on lambda here, what do you have to have? We've got r squared dr here, so we would have to have rho. So if rho was going like some constant, let's call it zeta over r cubed, then the integral, from lambda inverse to m inverse of 4 pi r squared rho of r dr would be basically 4 pi zeta, the integral from lambda inverse to m inverse of dr over r. And that would be 4 pi zeta. So that would be log of, these are inverses, so if I take the log, it's going to be log of, since I'm bad for signs, let me just do all the steps explicitly. So we have log of m inverse over lambda inverse. So we'll take the minus ones out explicitly, but then we like to write this as lambda over m. That gets it back. And I think I'd like to put a squared here, because that's what we have over there. And then it'll cost us a factor of 2. So if I compare this to this, you can see that we're expecting that zeta should be minus e squared over 48 pi cubed, period. Right? So what we're expecting, so what I want to be able to show you is that for because what I'm following here was for that was the lambda dependence. The reason I didn't care about this limit so much is that I'm not really following the order one dependence. I'm really trying to track the singular dependence of lambda. So for r much less than m inverse, so near the cutoff, what I want to be able to show you is that rho of r is going to go like minus e squared over 48 pi cubed 1 over r cubed. And there's a factor of q not running around here, right? So I should have carried that around. So q naught. So that's my goal, to show that that's true. So let's do that. So what we'll do now is we'll take the finite part here of pi, and we'll look at the scattering of heavy charges and ask what would be the potential that captures that scattering. So on the one hand, if we're just taking, you know, just doing, you know, scattering or charge, so we're doing the amplitude for the S matrix amplitude for charge 1 plus charge 2 goes to the scattered 1 plus the scattered 2. We're calculating this in you know, using the Feynman rules of QED, but we would have had, you know, just to remind you what the Lagrangian is, you know, we have an interaction term which is minus psi bar d slash plus m plus I e a slash psi. So the interaction term, and then we also had the kinetic term. The interaction piece was minus I e psi bar a slash psi plus the counter term stuff. So in this Feynman graph, we have a factor of, you know, we've got two vertices, so we'll have I times 2 pi to the fourth times the delta function, which expresses, you know, more momentum conservation. So if we take this to be, say, k prime, and this is q, or say, p prime and p. So we'd have delta of k prime plus, I guess let's call this, call that q if you like. And then we have that vertex gives us a factor of minus IE. And then the other vertex at the other end will be I times 2 pi to the fourth minus IE times the delta function, which says that Q plus P minus P prime is 0. And then we have the propagator, which is, you know, minus I over 2 pi to the fourth A to mu nu over Q squared minus I epsilon plus Q mu, term, Q give me a new term. And and all that's going to change here is now we're going to have to add the piece which corresponds to the vacuum polarization. So we'll have a new piece which is plus q squared a to mu nu minus q mu q nu times pi f q squared. So it's pi f because we had the infinite part plus the counter term. So in principle, there was a graph here also which had the same exchange, but where I had the counter term. And that's what canceled the infinite part, leaving us the finite part. So what will appear here is literally this thing here. And I guess we also, so we've done all the factors, but we haven't done the spinner lines here. So we have, those are muons or protons or something. So then we'll have u bar, u1 prime bar, gamma mu, u1. Then we'd have u bar 2 prime, gamma nu u2. Or these are the spinners for the initial and final fermions. All right, so this will give us something like, so that cancels that. We have minus I b squared. 2 pi to the fourth. We're supposed to, I guess, integrate over q. One of these delta functions tells us that q is equal to p minus p prime. The other delta function gives us the overall delta function conservation that p plus q, p plus k minus p prime minus k prime is 0. And then we've got u bar 1 prime. We've got a to mu nu. Oh, and I forgot something here. When I wrote this, I just wrote this factor, but really we had a propagator here and we have two propagators here. So I should have actually written 1 over q squared minus I epsilon squared. We've got a to mu nu over q squared minus I epsilon. That's a common factor that's in front of both these guys. Right, this is a curly bracket. Then I have 1 plus, I'm just focusing on the a to mu nu term, we've got a q squared over q squared. So all we'll be left with is a pi f, q squared. Then we have the q mu to q nu terms. Okay.
Pi over 2 pi to the fourth? Or is that included in the factor of pi of
f? Yeah, I was flopping about that. There would be an extra factor of I over 2 pi to the fourth, but there's also an extra vertex. So mm-hmm. We should have picked up what I didn't say carefully was that the remember when we did the vacuum polarization, the answer for evaluating this, when we didn't include the external lines, but the answer for the result was I times 2 pi to the fourth times pi mu nu. There was a conventional factor of I 2 pi to the fourth, that then a delta function, p minus p prime. And so that factor cancels the extra factor of minus I over 2 pi to the fourth from the propagator. And that's kind of why it's there, is that it's defined in such a way that these factors are what you would have gotten for any vertex, and this is kind of then playing the role of what the coupling would have been for that vertex. And so I should have done that through properly, but what I'm telling you here is the right result. Okay, so there's several things here. So one thing is that, as usual, these things don't contribute. And you can kind of see explicitly why they don't contribute, because it's always a q contracted with something like this. So the first, so we might as well just make that explicit. This is an example where you see why those things don't contribute. So so things like u bar 1, q slash u1 prime. Claim is that that's always 0. And the reason is that we know that q is equal to, if I'm taking these u's to be, let's say, the k's, we know that q is equal to k minus k prime. And so I can write this as being u1 bar prime k slash minus k slash prime u1. But the thing is that these u's satisfy the Dirac equation. So they satisfy that I k slash plus m on u is equal to 0. And we know that I k slash prime plus capital M, not electron mass, but whatever the mass of this thing is, u prime is equal to 0. And so that means that I can always take this u slash, this k slash, I can think of it acting on this u1, and it's going to give me 0. It's going to give me m, basically. This will be, if I think of this thing, we'll have u bar. This term here, I can trade k slash for im. So I'd have a minus im here. And if I think of this k slash acting on, sorry, I did that wrong. If I take this one acting on u, then I can take k slash is equal to im. So I have im in that term. But I can take this guy and think of it as acting on u bar. So if I take the bar of this equation, I'm going to get that u bar of minus I k slash plus m is equal to 0. And what happens is, take a dagger and a beta. Let's do this carefully. So u dagger, I would have a k slash dagger. And so what I now want to do is I want to multiply through by the u bar is u dagger beta, where beta is the matrix 0, 1, 1, 0, which is related to its I times gamma 0. So this is, so beta squared in particular is 1. So I can write this as being u dagger beta minus I k slash dagger plus m. And what I want to do is I want to multiply through by beta here. So let me multiply through by beta. What I'd like to do is derive an expression for u bar. So this is u bar. And then what I've got here is I've got minus I beta k slash dagger beta from this term. And I've got plus m beta squared. Right, this whole thing is equal to 0. Right, what I've done, I've taken this thing, I've taken the dagger of it, so it's still 0. I've multiplied through by beta, so it's still 0, and that's I'm falling here. Beta squared is 1, so I can ignore that. Now there's an identity that beta times any gamma matrix dagger times beta is plus or minus that gamma matrix again, and you should prove to yourself that this is minus gamma mu for the vector. So this will be u bar plus I k slash plus m. So because of that, what we're going to get here is, again, we'll get im u1. And you can see that now they cancel, so that's equal to 0. So basically, the idea is that you can trade the q slash for the Dirac equation acting on the initial and final state, and they are canceling at the end of the day. And the same thing would work on the other line. So if we contract a q with the other combination here, the u2s, it's also true that q is equal to p minus p prime as well as k minus k prime. And so so that's what allows us to ignore this term and this term and follow only this term. So now the next thing I want to do is take the non-relativistic limit. So the non-relativistic limit, let me just claim what the answer is, but you can verify it yourself. It's just, I'm just using the properties of these Dirac spinners. So the claim is, so in the non-relativistic limit, u bar 1 prime gamma mu u1 times u bar 2 prime gamma mu u2 is basically, these things all depended on spins, right? So this could have been spin 1, spin 2, what do we call this, S? Spin 1 prime, I guess, spin 1. We'll call this spin 2 prime, spin 2. And this just becomes delta, basically delta sigma 1 prime, delta sigma 2 prime. Because basically all that survives is the gamma 0 term here, and then you're picking off the orthogonality of these things. These become just u dagger u, and so these spins have to be equal to each other. And this is plus order, you know, v squared over c squared. And similarly, the q squared is, in that case, it's, you know, it was minus q0 minus q0 prime. Or sorry, it's minus q0 squared plus 3q squared. And so if I think in terms of the momenta, that would be minus, say, k0 minus k0 prime squared plus 3 momentum k minus 3 momentum k prime squared. But this difference, you know, the rest mass is going to cancel in this thing, and this is going to be something of the order of k squared over m. Right, so it's suppressed by the mass, so this is something of the order of v again. So the energy difference in the non-relativistic limit is subdominant because the leading energy is the rest mass, and that just cancels. And then the subdominant piece is quadratic in the velocities. And so this is something which is order v squared over c squared, whereas this is something which is bigger than that. So to the leading approximation non-relativistically, it's only the spatial momentum that's going to be important in this four velocity squared. So it's basically q squared. So unfortunately, I want to be able to see this other board, so let me do this on another board over here. Okay, so now I'm just going to plug this into this. And you see that, you know, this is basically always contracted by the metric, so this is just becoming deltas in spin space. We've got the 1 over q squared, which is becoming 1 over 3 momentum. And then pi is being evaluated as a function of 3 momentum, basically. So we're getting something which looks like an S matrix element. You know, so for 1 plus 2 goes to 1 prime plus 2 prime. It's a good approximation. It's just minus IE. Times 1 over, or sorry, it's delta. Sigma 1 prime, delta sigma 2 prime, times 1 over 3 momentum squared, 1 plus pi f 3 momentum squared. Is that right? Okay. Let me get to a point where we can equate something, and then that'll be a good place to start. So what I want to do now is compare that to potential scattering. So since it's all non-relativistic, we can think about potential scattering. So for potential scattering, just in quantum mechanics, you know, in Born approximation. What we would have is we have something which is involving, we get some potential, and in position space, you know, we've got x1, x2. Let me make sure I use the same notation as my notes. Yeah, I'm using primes as the final state. So 1 prime, 2 prime. I could have done it the other way around. But... So in terms of a potential function, this would have been something which is local. So it only happens when everybody's at the same spot. We have a delta of x1 minus x2. V of x1 minus x2. So this could be action at a distance if they're separated. But the what we're requiring is that it's the position of the, in the scattering for potential, we're requiring this to be local and this to be local, but they could be separated in space. And if we did this in momentum space, then this would have corresponded to k1, k2, K1 prime, K2 prime. It would just turn out to be 1 over 2 pi cubed integral d3x of e to the minus I q dot x times v of x, where I'm using that v now, times delta cubed of K1 plus K2. K1 prime plus K2 prime. And the thing is, the S matrix is, in Born approximation, just proportional to the matrix element of the potential. So this is the thing that the potential, if we calculate the same scattering rate for a potential, what we would have found is potential scattering. 1 plus 2 goes to 1 prime plus 2 prime. It would have been minus 2 pi I, in the same conventions that I used over there, times this matrix element, 1 over 2 pi cubed, the integral 3x of e to the minus I. Q here, I should have said, is Q is k minus k prime. And it's also equal to k1 minus k1 prime, k2 prime minus k2. And if I want to assume here that it's a spin-independent potential. So if it's spin-independent, what we'll get is a delta function, sigma 1 prime. So I'm assuming the potential only acts on position space. Missing a V of somewhere, V of X. Okay, so if I compare that to that, we can read off what V is, right? So the upshot is that if we equate the two S matrices, then what the V that we would need has to satisfy, and I forgot to write the charges, so that's stupid. So right here, I wrote E squared. And I'm implicitly assuming there that the charges of these things that we're scattering was 1. But I actually want to follow the charge of these things because I'm trying to see how they're screened. So let me put I forgot to write a factor of Q1, Q2 here for the product. It's the charge of each of these fermions we're scattering in units of E. And so we would have here had Q1, Q2. So with that choice, then we have Q1. Q2, 1 plus pi f over q squared divided by q squared should be equal to the integral d3x of e to the minus I q dot x v of x. So that's how v would be related to pi. And so if I solve that for V, then that means that V of X, I just take the inverse Fourier transform, is going to be Q1, Q2 over 2 pi cubed integral D3Q of E to the I Q dot X 1 over Q squared. So if we didn't have this term, then this is what you would recognize as being the Coulomb potential. So this would give us the Coulomb and the 1 over Q squared in momentum space turns into 1 over R in position space. And I guess that's probably the formula I want you to remember here. Because next thing I want to do is I want to say, if I had had a charge distribution, where am I going? I want to argue that there's a charge distribution here. So if we were scattering from a charge distribution, that would be a specific a charge distribution where all the charges are interacting through the Coulomb interaction. Then that would also give a very specific statement for what the potential should have been that you'd be interacting with. And so I'd like to take the potential for a charge distribution and equate it to this, and then we can solve for the charge distribution in terms of pi. That's the final place where we're going to go. And then that'll give us an expression for the charge distribution as a function of pi. And then once we have that charge distribution, I can look at the small r limit and ask, is it looking like 1 over r cubed? And is it doing the things that I told you we wanted it to be doing in order to reproduce the lambda dependence that we had, which I hope is still on one of these boards here. So once we find the charge distribution that gives us this particular potential, the claim will be that for small r, it does this. And we can read off, you know, the e squared over 48 pi cubed should be something we just read off from the expression. Okay, that's a good place to stop.